Good morning and welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. My name is Sandra Barrett, and on behalf of University College of Syracuse University, it's my pleasure to welcome you here today, this morning, when we're going to be talking about Interstate 81 and Syracuse. First, I want to give you a heads up, a reminder about next week's conversation. We're going to be talking about the Greater Syracuse Land Bank. It's a new corporation, a new initiative. It's a countywide initiative. Caitlin Wright, who's the executive director, and Vito Ciccioli, who is the chair of the board, are going to be here. There have been a lot of questions about it's something really new in the state and even in the nation. So it'll be a good opportunity to get firsthand about what they're doing, what their plans are. So I highly recommend that. And then, of course, we will take a week off. We will celebrate Thanksgiving, and then we will come back in December with two education-related programs with Superintendent Contreras from the city and Dr. Craybill, the new president of OCC. So that will be in December. So, again, welcome. I want to just remind you, you all know that the Onondaga Citizens League is a sister organization of TMR. It was really started by a group of TMR members something over 35 years ago as a way to study a particular community issue in depth each year. So, of course, we urge you all to support the Citizens League as an arm of TMR or as a sister organization. But back in 2008, when the New York State Department of Transportation was just beginning to talk about the I-81 project, the I-81 challenge or opportunity, the Citizens League really embarked on an inquiry that was intended to help citizens think creatively about, you know, what could happen when the interstate viaduct was reconstructed or when the project came about. We looked at what other cities were doing, and we really tried to take it as an opportunity to look at things creatively and futuristically. Well, now we have another group of folks who are taking that another step further, and that is Alt-81. And we'll hear a bit about Alt-81, which is a project of Upstate, a design center at Syracuse University's School of Architecture. So it's my pleasure to introduce you today to Mark Norman, who is the executive director at Upstate. He's been there for about a year and a half. Upstate does a lot of different, it's really a coalition of different architecture and planning and development people. They've been working on different projects in the city on the Near West Side, the Connective Corridor, and really trying to get at, you know, what can older post-industrial cities like Syracuse and others do to kind of renew themselves. Mark came to us from New York City, where he was a vice president in the Community Development Finance Group at Deutsche Bank. Before that, he was the managing director at a real estate development firm in New York that helped government agencies and private developers do different kinds of urban revitalization. And he also worked in Los Angeles at the Skid Row Housing Trust. He's gotten involved in Housing Visions Board here in Syracuse, and we're very lucky to have him here today. So please join me in welcoming Mark Norman.
Good morning. Hello. I wanted to talk today about what we've been doing at the Architecture School and at Upstate around 81. I got here about a year and a half ago, so the 81 challenge process had already been underway, and one of the first things I did was read the report that Sandra talked about from the Onondaga Citizens League, which was very well done, but had been done in 2007, and she encouraged us, actually, to take that work forward as this process unfolded. And boy, has it unfolded. and so I want to first say that we're really coming to this in a neutral way. We're looking at the facts and the data, no push-polling. We're just trying to get the facts out and educate people. So when we looked at this, we really looked at precedents and other ways cities have looked at aging infrastructure and what to do at the end of its useful life. So what I want to show you today is, very quickly, what we've done both in the Architecture School and at Upstate. So In 2008, Seattle commissioned a study that looked at every highway to boulevard scenario that had been done in the United States and abroad. That's 20 projects. And they narrowed it down to 8 and looked at all 8 cities, which included Portland, San Francisco, Boston, Seoul, Korea, Chattanooga, Trenton, Vancouver, Toronto, and Milwaukee. And they did very in-depth analysis, so I encourage you to look at that study. But it had an executive summary, and what they found in all of those cities was traffic decreased, removal had a catalytic effect, values increased, crime decreased, perceptions of safety changed, no city showed negative impacts of roadway reductions. Roadway reductions actually reduced the number of auto trips, and traffic redispersed itself. So amazing findings. SMTC and DOT, I don't think, have seen this study or looked at this study. So I encourage them to look at that as well, because I think press... I meant that in a very neutral way. I really didn't. But I encourage people to look at precedents, because I think they're very important. And I know that when we say something happened in Seoul or Pittsburgh or Milwaukee, that it's easy to say it's not Syracuse. But I think we can look at the ways it is like Syracuse and take some of those lessons away from us. So what we wanted to do was basically create a presentation that we can upload to YouTube and Vimeo that people can use as a way of talking through some of these issues. So we know the tortured history of the interstate highway and its detrimental effect on our cities. They were really meant to go around our cities, and in many cases, they ended up going through our cities. And we're at a historic moment here where we can actually have an effect and not repeat some of the same mistakes. So we mapped some of those precedents I talked about. As we went through each one, we looked at their specific characteristics. And in many cases, like 81, many of them are coming to the end of their useful life. So what we did was we looked and we created a table, and I'm sorry that this is illegible, but it will be on our website and it will be on the video when we upload it. But it basically shows a number of cities that face this issue. Some of their highways stayed up, but they found creative ways of using the undersides, of incorporating retail, of reconnecting the streets. Others became highways to boulevards. In a lot of the precedent studies, including the SMTCs, they did studies and showed why the precedents weren't relevant for Syracuse. What we tried to do was not just take highway to boulevard projects, we also tried to take existing conditions where highways stopped, either because they were never continued because of public opposition, like Pasadena, California, where you have now 40 years of data about where a highway ends and becomes a boulevard and starts. We wanted to see what the results of that were. So what we did was we did a little bit of an analysis of, on the left you'll see our 81 condition, on the right you'll see in this precedent, Pasadena, and how traffic moves, what the number of cars are per hour, how the traffic flows. And we did that for each precedent that you see here. So we did that also for San Francisco, which took down their central freeway. Unlike San Francisco or other places, we don't have a natural disaster. We just have a long-running infrastructure disinvestment. And in San Francisco, because of the earthquake, they immediately had to find out what it was like not to have the freeway everybody counted on. And what they found right after the earthquake was traffic redistributed itself, which paved the way for them to be able to take down the central freeway, and then paved the way also for thinking about taking down the Embarcadero freeway. So those kind of precedents are interesting because looking at these cases, when people had no warning and a natural disaster, still you had a situation where traffic redistributed itself. So I think it's important to look at here as we think about Syracuse, not about earthquakes, but about traffic redistributing itself. So in our 81 specific work, it's incredibly important. It's 12% of the gross domestic product of the U.S. travels on this expressway. It connects us to Canada. It's an incredibly important route. And I think that has to be taken into account. Luckily, we have 481 as a bypass. And so, you know, I think we have to acknowledge that it's an incredibly important road and incredibly important to people getting north to south and also getting east to west. West probably being the biggest problem in terms of rethinking 81. So one of the things we did was, in looking at this corridor, looking at travel times. So right now it takes approximately 7 minutes to travel on various corridors. And then we looked at the history. And as we looked at the history, we also wanted to acknowledge that in the path of 81 were neighborhoods and houses and people. And as we rethink what to do with 81, I think it's important to honor those neighborhoods and that history, and also think about what we lost. So it wasn't just the highway, of course, it was urban renewal. It was a kind of double whammy that happened that, you know, and architects are definitely to blame and planners even more so. But, you know, this notion that uses should be separated, that super blocks were better than a gridded street, that we should have buildings on plinths, and that older neighborhoods weren't really valuable. And so you can see over time in the demographics that that sort of double whammy of urban renewal and the construction of 81 shows in the 15th Ward census tract really a steady decrease in population and a decrease in median incomes, which match sort of those urban initiatives at the time. So this is another image which some of our students did, which I thought was really fascinating, which is this is the historic fabric pre-81. This is now. And it's an incredible, I mean, you just see the incredible loss of density. You see the incredible loss of fabric, of neighborhoods, of businesses. And then we also did a study of population per square mile, and you can also see the decline, and this is a little abstract, this diagram, but you can see the decline of population in the central city and the increase in population in the outer regions of the city. Then we also looked at median household incomes, and you also see very stark disparities between the outlying areas and downtown Syracuse and its inner neighborhoods. So we also looked at regional employers because we were trying to look holistically at this moment that we have in front of us. Many of the regional employers are outside of the city. So in looking at some of the ways that we move forward with 81, it's important to know who those regional employers are. So in terms of travel times, and this is incredibly small and I apologize, we showed from different places different travel times. And for people north, it's not that much of an issue, and especially for people traveling south to north or north to south, because 481 really only adds 2 to 3 minutes if you're doing the whole trip. The issues do arise when you're going south into the city and west. And so just looking at some of those things we thought was important, and we listed them. So post 81, this is the condition we live with now. He's jogging, I think, not running for his life. But you see people, you know, when we see students that have to cross this barrier, and when we asked for a show of hands of our students, one of them had a car out of 18. And so it was important for them, actually, when they think about 81, they think about it truly as a barrier, as something that is dangerous to cross when they have to get downtown. And, you know, a lot of them said that's one of the things that keeps them on the hill, is this barrier and having to breach it. So In the SMTC study, there were five options. What we tried to do was make them more legible. There were, I think it sowed a little bit of confusion, the process and the way it was outlined. And so we were thinking, how can we as architects and planners rationalize what was an amazing process that produced probably 1,000 pages of documentation, but was hard to actually figure out legibly in one graphic how sort of what we were looking at. So we looked at, and this also is relatively small, but we just took what they saw as the issues and what would be done under each scenario: reconstruction, tunnel, depressed highway, rebuild, rehab. So I think this is a close-up. And one of the things that we thought we could add to was that when they showed renderings, what we learn in architecture and planning school is that you really should cut sections at each portion so people get an idea of what the total possibilities are. And when they gave us the rendering of the new highway, they showed us a parking lane, a bike lane, no cars, and just half of the viaduct. So what we did was down, there's a clicker pointer here, but I don't want to turn it off by accident. But at the bottom left, we modeled what that axis would be and what people should actually see, which is the whole new viaduct with its wider lanes, and what properties would have to be taken. Because I think that would have been a really interesting thing to show people and really spurred a lot of discussion that wasn't spurred because I think we were given a choice at the time of boulevard or highway. Not, you know, a boulevard has certain consequences and a highway will tear down these specific properties and will be 12 lanes wide, which is wider than currently planned. And that, I think, could generate a lot more discussion and have a more nuanced discussion. So in terms of the boulevard, the other thing is this was the rendering of the boulevard. And I wouldn't want to drive on that boulevard. I wouldn't want to walk across that boulevard. That's not a good precedent or notion of a boulevard. I mean, I think we deserve the best boulevard possible when the costs are estimated between $400 million and $1 billion, depending on the outcome. So we also need better renderings of boulevards and need to know at each intersection what that boulevard looks like, how you cross it, where you park, can we actually support bus rapid transit? So I think those issues were important too. And I think in the data they talked about that, but in the presentation it was hard to understand what the outcome was going to be. So we just felt like each option had some negative impacts. So in this next process, we want to ask some questions, especially what can we do differently in Syracuse? So this was the 81 challenge process. We're now in a new process, the scoping of which started yesterday, and we can all submit either testimony or information or reports for that. So I'm sure many people are doing that. We're going to do that. But we wanted to ask some questions. And we started this process in the spring, and so we did a design studio with the students. So they did more visionary thinking about what could happen to the viaduct. We did a real estate seminar that looked at what some of the economic potentials were for it. Then we did an exhibition of their work in June. And then just recently, the AIA was in town for their New York State convention, and we did a charrette with the architects from all over New York State and some of our students to also think it through. So all of this has generated some of the questions that we want the DOT to answer through their EIS process. So students can be whimsical, and I think it's great. There were high-line schemes, high-line-like schemes. There were ways of looking at, if the viaduct was rebuilt, how you incorporate retail. There were incorporations of parks and other things. So I think it was a really interesting exercise, and it's important to think sort of in a visionary way to get at some of the issues that you might actually incorporate. I don't think the sort of out-of-the-box thinking is unuseful. I think actually it can help us think through some of the possibilities. So what are the questions? What we want to do is, this is pretty brief, but we're going to animate these slides so that there's more of a sense with these questions of what we're talking about, but I'll just go through them. So identifying the barriers, West Street, the viaduct itself, 690. So what are the current barriers? What does the DOT think are the current barriers? What are the most vibrant areas? Destiny, the Hill, downtown, north side. Can this project remove barriers and reconnect the city's vibrant areas more effectively? So not just think about it as a viaduct project, but think about how we actually reconnect Syracuse. And then also, what are the measures of success of a major transportation project? Well, one is slower cars kill less people. I think that's a really good thing to think about as we think about the future. Many highway departments, and they've actually changed significantly for the better, but they have metrics like levels of service. And so a level of service of A is a very 1950s thinking that says basically the perfect condition for a highway is going 10 miles over the speed limit and having 27 car lengths on either side of you. And that's sort of a level of comfort that's considered A. For most urban expressways, they say that a C is acceptable, but that's still 16 car lengths on either side. So when I think of a vibrant city, I don't think of driving and having 16, you know, car lengths on in front or in back of me. And so I think if you start with those metrics, and not metrics like how do you connect a city or how do you get cars efficiently from point A to point B while also stimulating economic development, then you get very wide highways. So I think they should look at all sorts of metrics. Is it possible to have connectivity and good urbanism? I think so. Other cities have done it. We should look at those precedents. Is it possible to have both connectivity and good urbanism? So what we're doing is we're just looking at all the one-way streets in downtown Syracuse now. And what would happen if we looked at those as becoming two-way streets? How would the traffic flow? So all these things, we just want the DOT to model. We want to make sure that they're looking at all of these things and not just how to move people from Tennessee to Canada. So is it possible? This is West Street. This is Octavia Boulevard in San Francisco. Same number of lanes, but used very differently. And West Street is very important in this conversation because I think some people might be looking at it as a way of alleviating traffic, but if you move the problem from one place to another, I don't know that you solve the problem. What are the ways the entire transit system can be modified to reduce traffic demand on 81? So just looking at other ways people get in and out of the city. What are the ways it can be modified? So this is about right now you have one exit and one entrance when you get on or off 81, Harrison and Adams. So if it was taken down, all of a sudden you have 14 connections, right? You have all of those blocks now that you could make right or left turns on. And cars back up. You know, if you only have one exit for everybody going downtown or to the Hill, it's a very different condition than having a gridded street pattern where people can make right and left turns wherever they want to go. So thinking about reestablishing historic blocks, we have a lot of super blocks, blocks that used to go through that don't anymore. And many of those have buildings on them now that block where the street used to go through, but some of them don't. So we just looked at where that is the case. And then thinking about the whole transit system. So looking all the way down to 481, what are some of the possibilities of taking traffic off earlier before it gets into town? So with a takedown, also, we gain a lot of land from the ramps that are currently there. So what is that land? We took a guess at what land might become available, but I think they can tell us very definitively because they're designing the highway. And then if it was rebuilt, what would we lose? What land would be taken? What properties seized? What historic structures torn down? So looking at new widths, if it stays up. And then when we talk about transit, I think the important question for urban planners is there's certain densities that merit certain levels of transit. So we're not going to have a subway system here because we don't have the density in particular places. But at as little as 20 to 30 units per acre, you can have an efficient bus or rapid bus system. So also when we look at what parcels might be reclaimed and how downtown develops, we can think about those transit options. But it's hard to think about those transit options unless you think about what kinds of densities can support those transit options. And then just as we come to a boulevard, can we think about speed, reduction in speeds? And then Sandra actually, I think, sent out something yesterday, but 81 was closed for a while, which I didn't realize. And after a day or so of chaos, traffic kind of redistributed itself. So if we're undertaking a $32 million study, can we actually spend a couple of days closing roads, turning one-way streets to two-ways, even with cones, just to test what some possibilities might be? And then I'm sure the bane of many of our existences is signalization of lights. If we actually took the lights and signalized them so that the traffic flowed and pedestrians had safe crossings, what would that do also for redistributing the traffic and making it flow in different ways? And then coordinating with the city. It has to be part of a larger plan. It can't just be a transportation project. So will there be an overlay zone that has different zoning, that does something about the parking lots that now line the viaduct? So I think we need to think holistically about the city. And then just efficient transportation options. There's all sorts of innovations in transportation now where you can have reverse flow lanes for game days and other things. So I think we should look at where that's happening in other cities. So I'm sure there'll be questions and other things, so I'll just sort of go through this. But these are the many questions we just want to pose to the DOT. We don't have the money to study them, but they do. And when we submit questions, my hope is that they can actually give us some of these answers. So enhancing the pedestrian environment, there's been a decline in vehicle miles driven. So when they projected out, when they first built 81, they projected increase in car traffic every year from 1968 to infinity. And, you know, is this a trend? Should we study driving patterns and other things as we project for the next 50 years? Because this will be up for 50 years. So 50 years from now, if we have other means of transportation or other ways of getting around, it's important to look at some of those things. And then definitely demolition of structures. Roundabouts, is that a possibility? So just things we want them to look at in a very neutral way, just, you know, I'm sure we all sit around like, well, what if this happened and what if that happened? I think we can ask those questions and get them to study them for us. So recreational opportunities. And then an interim plan during construction. This is going to be a multi-year process, and it's going to affect a lot of people. So also, not only what are you going to do with the viaduct, but what are you going to do in the interim when people have to get to the hill, to games, to their housing? So those are also important questions. So we're going to ask them those questions and make them do the work, hopefully. But we can also do some things ourselves. And so a fun thing we can do is Street Mix. It's called streetmix.com. I don't know if you guys have seen it, but if you go onto it, you can literally create your perfect street. And it's free. And so all you do is, at the bottom, it's a little small, but you see everything from heavy rail to light rail to cars to bikes to pedestrians, and you just drag and drop, and you can create your street. So I think everybody should go home and go on streetmix.com, create your own street, and send it to the DOT. But the other thing is, I think there are so many interesting ways to model these days that they should be looking at that for us too. And let's see if I can get this.
While we're looking at that, I just wanted to let everybody know that we will post on the TMR website, we'll post a link to Mark's presentation. We'll also post a link to the Onondaga Citizens League study report and also the blog that we did in conjunction with the study that speaks to a lot of these issues, including that closure in, I think it was 1998, of it was closures just of first the northbound and then the southbound lanes or vice versa. And then we will also post the link to the new New York State Department of Transportation scoping process. This is the next phase that is required by the Environmental Protection Act and requiring them to do more in the way of environmental impact studies on all of the alternatives. So taking all of the comments from the earlier SMTC process and then working it into another process. So there is a lot out there. There is still a lot of time, as Mark said, for input and about what we want out of this transportation project.
So the last thing I'm going to show is just the new modeling technology, which I can't afford, but I know that Parsons has. And I think they want, I really want them to model what all of these things are going to look like. And so I'm just going to show a simulation of the kind of software that transportation engineers have access to these days for modeling. So you can literally model all the buildings, the streets, the traffic patterns. You can put in the number of cars. I think this is much more helpful for having a discussion than showing static renderings. And they have the possibility of doing this. So I really want them to show us what happens at Almond and Fayette. What happens when cars come down from the hill? What happens on game day? They can do that. They can model all of this. So my hope is that they can provide some of these kind of graphics to us so that we can have a real discussion and say, well, that's my car, or I'm that pedestrian, like, and I'm going in a certain direction. How do I get there, and what are the times? It's a simulation, but I think it gives us a much better way of starting a discussion. Well, it's a very expensive software modeling, building information management program, but I'm sure Parsons has the money to put that together.
All right, thank you. I'm going to turn the lights off, take questions. I think one of the points that Mark made about the modeling and the assumptions, I think departments of transportation, not just in New York but all over the place, have, we typically assume increases in everything. You know, everything goes up with time. Well, we know that doesn't necessarily happen. Housing prices. So, right. So traffic has actually kind of stabilized, and I think it's important to the modeling process to think about, as you said, what if we have other modes of transportation or other parking and commuting options, then what would happen there? And then maybe that's something we hadn't thought about. But I'm sure there are some questions. And so if anyone has a question, please raise your hand, and I will try to get to you.
I live in Camillus, and I occasionally come into Syracuse. I've done some surveying of my own in Camillus as far as our Route 81 relocation is concerned. And the answer, the most direct answer I get is I don't want to have anything changed because I want to be able to get through Syracuse with 2 minutes or less. And that's about it. Mm-hmm. And so we had a recent survey done. I was one of the people questioned in that survey over the telephone. And I had the same impression that they want everything to stay exactly as it is. And if you have a question or a survey only involving mostly county residents, you're going to get the same response. Don't change it.
Yeah.
Can you speak to that? I mean, I think that what we've heard is that not changing anything is not an option. Even if you have a new viaduct, it's not necessarily going to look. And that's why I think we encourage, what Upstate is trying to do is to get people to participate and ask the DOT people. For instance, last night, if you had gone, or you can go on their website, again, we'll post the website, and look at what they are proposing, and you may see that a lot of the answers aren't there yet, but, because patching forever is not an option, a new road is not going to look the same. So the people in Camillus might be surprised on what, we all might be surprised. Right. And that's why I really like that idea of the modeling, because looking at those drawings is so hard, but looking at an actual live modeling would give us all a better idea of what it's going to do to us.
But I think you're exactly right. It's a question, and it's going to change, but it's hard for us to figure that out. There are transportation engineers that have years of expertise that I think should be answering those kind of questions for us.
I think a lot of us get ensnared in protecting our current interests, whether it's how fast I can get through Syracuse or how my business will fare. Can you give us any indication of when this facility will actually be up and running? Because I bet it's 40 years. I bet none of us will be here. and try to move the community forward on things like driverless vehicles or alternate forms of transportation, air pollution conditions, economic conditions that none of us in this community have brought to the fore in this discussion.
No. I really don't have any answer for that. Mm-hmm. I hope it's not 40 years, because that would mean a lot of patching. Yeah.
I think it would be helpful, Mark, if your students and the DOT looked at what happened in Dallas. Have you looked at Dallas? Because they put the interstate 6 lanes in a ditch. And then subsequently, and there were 3, as I remember, maybe 4 major bridges over that ditch, which would be the ones that would cross here. Subsequently, they covered it over, and it's now a beautiful park used by everybody, from people playing frisbees and having concerts, and it clearly no longer separates the two sections of the city.
Yeah.
That was done in 2 ways. The original construction was paid for by public funds. The covered park was built with private funds that were raised in the city of Dallas.
Right. And it connected the museums, if I remember, too. Yeah. Yeah, no, I think it's a great example. And I think what we were doing was, there's certain, if the notion is a boulevard or a rebuilt highway, then the precedents start falling into those categories. But I think there's so many other precedents that they should look at, like Dallas or like Pasadena, where it actually never happened. So you had a freeway that ended and just never got extended. So I think those other precedents that we don't think of as precedents are good for them to look at and tell us how it's relevant or not relevant.
And from talking to one of the DOT people last night at the scoping session, the depressed highway idea is on the table, although it could not follow the same corridor as I-81. It would have to move a bit to the east, and they have some ideas of where it would go down and where it would come up, but what they don't have yet is any idea of, and it would go down and come up and then go down and come up again, so they don't have any idea of the costs. And as much as we would like to say, it cost money's no object, it will be. So I have a question for you, Mark, and that is about, I'm not sure, as you were going through some of the questions, do any of the questions have to do with the air quality impacts? And that, because I think that is something that is of concern to people. You know, if you take traffic from however many feet above the ground it is and bring it down, or if you take, you know, 10,000 cars or 12,000 cars a day and move them, does it have a detrimental impact on somebody else, or does it help the people who, you know, live, you know, just yards away from the highway?
Yeah.
Is that one of the questions that's in your modeling?
Or? It wasn't in the questions here, just because that's a harder question for us as architects and planners.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of a public health question and an air monitoring question, but it's a relevant question.
Mm-hmm. I wondered if in from the architect's point of view, though, are there, we know green homes, for instance, you did a competition for green homes on the west side. Are there any sort of construction or HVAC techniques that are new to people who are stuck living next to a highway or a lot of traffic? Is there anything in that sort of new technology about, you know, what you would do if you were constructing near a highway?
Uh-huh. I mean, I think the best thing is to probably get rid of the highway.
Oh, okay. All right, we have a question here.
What makes you think that the bureaucrats, and I don't mean this in a pejorative way, but what makes you think that the bureaucrats are going to take all of your suggestions to heart and are going to work with you, given the fact that they're receiving so much input from so many different sources? What makes you think, and how hopeful are you that your suggestions will be considered and that they will work with you?
I'd like to remain hopeful. I hope, I mean, they're under their process, they're supposed to listen. They're supposed to take information and questions. So I hope that that process plays out in that way. So I'm trying to remain hopeful.
I understand in the city of Buffalo, they're considering extending their elevated rail system to the town of Amherst, which is a large township just to the north of the city. Yeah. And their primary motivation is that there's enormous development downtown with the medical center and other activities in the center core. And the congestion, because of the development of those operations, has been enormous, and that's why they're looking for mass transit alternatives. Given the fact that if I-81 comes down, our prime assets are the medical center and the university, it's inevitable that they're going to spread and that there's going to be concurrent development of other kinds of activities. Is it really unrealistic to think that we can't have some kind of rail system that uses the existing territory that 81 to the north into the city could employ, given, you know, the potential for revitalizing the center part of the city?
Oh, yeah, I think that's completely possible. But I think that's another thing that I think the city and the DOT need to model, you know, to think about, you know, 10 years out, if, you know, the university has a West Campus plan and the hospitals have plans to grow, what does that mean for the transportation, and build it in now? Because I think doing that after the fact makes it more expensive and, you know, sometimes impossible. But I think, you know, definitely there's a, you know, the density is there on the hill. The question is where, if people are coming from 45 different places, it doesn't work. But if there are, if there are densities in various nodes, it definitely works.
He answered the question. Well, from just looking at Greg Tripoli here, thinking about the buildings that are in the wake of whatever happens, even a deconstruction, have your students looked at that from a historic preservation standpoint of what buildings are, or could that be in the purview of something that your students do in the future, looking at the implications for buildings, whether they're historic or just in the path.
Well, I mean, I think with the students we tried, and you probably saw there were no renderings of what a boulevard might look like, or we tried to stay away from that because I think that always opens you up to questions. So we basically guessed and just used lines to show if it was built to current federal standards, what properties might be in the way, because that's something we felt like the studies that have been done haven't done. And is one of the most important things. Like, if your property is going to be taken, and we had a 2.5-year process, and we didn't end that process by saying, like, your property will be in danger, your property will be in danger under this scenario, then that's a real missing piece. So we outlined what properties we thought, but, you know, we're just not transportation engineers, so we don't know where they would put the right-of-way or if it's rebuilt, you know, how they make those 12-foot-wide lanes. So we outlined it, but we didn't say this property in specifics.
Okay. Thank you for your presentation. Could you talk a little bit about the lessons learned from the Big Dig in Boston and what those implications are in terms of kind of data management? You're advocating modeling, but there's also some concerns about Syracuse has inadequate information about its what's under the ground, so to speak, and particularly in this area. Yeah. How can this process help to enable Syracuse to become more data-rich about its conditions under the ground in terms of infrastructure and the lessons learned from the Big Dig? And then finally, if you could talk about what you see proactive local governments, such as what the cities, counties, universities, other big players could do to help advance a more holistic approach.
Yeah. I mean, the Big Dig, I like looking at precedents, but I feel like that is hard to look at it as a precedent. I mean, it was, I think, 25 years, 30 years. Oh, actually, to your point, maybe we will all be dead in this. But that was an incredibly long process and incredibly complicated. You know, it involved sort of multiple neighborhoods and underground conditions. And so, I mean, a tunnel is just hard. I think they always go over budget. I think they're incredibly complicated in terms of what's under the ground and what you find. So I don't. It's hard to use that as a precedent, especially with its cost overruns. I mean, that might have killed tunnel projects for the next 20 years just because it was so over budget. And then actually the construction was flawed when it opened, which closed it for a while. So it's hard to use that as a precedent. But I think if we're not transportation engineers or civil engineers, I think right now all I feel we can do is try to ask the right questions so that they can study the things that are important to get us to a good outcome.
I'm sorry. I have a question over here. Thanks.
Yeah. Two areas to model. Just wondering if you're planning on it. One would be, Sandra talked about the use of trains for 81, and I was part of it, and I think I could count on a hand or two, plus my feet, how many people traveled that way. But there were, you know, there is that possibility of trains coming from both the south and the north. The second question would be, in Florida, you see pedestrian and bike bridges that go over interstates quite successfully. Have you thought of modeling those two?
We've thought about asking the questions. We've definitely thought about asking the questions. But one thing I forgot to mention was last week I was in Detroit and a man named Peter Park, who was the head planner that took down Milwaukee's freeway and rethought Denver's, a spur of one of Denver's freeways was there. And so I asked him, you know, how did you do that? And he said, really, we had to work around DOT. They weren't on board. It really had to be a grassroots process, and the city had to be on board and be out front, and that's the only way it got done. And I thought that was interesting, is that, I mean, I hope this process is different, but he said in every instance where he's been in a city charged with taking down a highway or reimagining a highway, the city had to be incredibly proactive and fight at every turn to get the best outcomes and fight in some ways against the Department of Transportation. So I think that might be a lesson here. The other thing he said, which I thought was funny, was when he talked to them, the first thing they said was, it's too early to know, or it's too late to change. So we shouldn't accept those statements.
There was a question about the timing, and I know that from the SMTC charts, we had one of them up, and I don't know if we could find it here. The deadlines were kind of a moving target. I just looked at the new state viaduct project, and they don't have a timeline per se. They have a flow chart. They got smart. They did not put any dates on there. I think originally it was something, though, like thinking about construction starting in 2015 or deconstruction anyway, because we know that even deconstruction, no matter whether you are reconstructing whatever, is going to take at least probably about a year, I would think, at least. So, again, I'll put up the link to the state and this environmental review process. There's a time for comments for this particular scoping process is through January, the mid-January. So you have some time to look it over and then put your comments in here. Oh, well, to look it over and also to look over, some of these other precedents. Mark talked about the Seattle process when the Citizens League started its study in 2008. We were lucky enough to have one of the transportation planners who worked in Seattle, happened to be a Central New Yorker who was home for a vacation, came and gave us a presentation. So we speak to that, and I think we also have links to that, although Seattle decided to go the tunnel route. That was a case where the citizenry, I think the city wanted a boulevard, but the state DOT decided on the tunnel option. So we'll be watching that one too. But again, the timeline I think is still up in the air. They last night at the first scoping session, they were not able to give us any idea of when the next session would be. I think it depends on the kinds of comments they get and how they get along in their process. So we have time for one more question. Do you have a question, Arlene, or a thought?
Will, your presentation was wonderful. I love thinking out of the box. Will any of your representatives, students or you, be at the next session to present your ideas or to deal with them?
Well, we've been actually meeting with a lot of people, and I'm hopeful that a group that's advocating for data and facts and good outcomes for the city and the region will emerge. And so I think that coalition will hopefully be very active. But we're definitely giving testimony and submitting what we've done and submitting these questions as well.
One more.
When we're talking about pedestrians and bike paths and things like that, we look at the maps and it looks like it's flat. But when we're looking at the link between the university and the downtown, we know it's not flat. It's like a 20-story grade difference. And I just wonder how that factors into the discussion about barriers.
Yeah. Well, very personally for me, because I ride my bike up. I work downtown, but I have to ride up to the hill every day. And so it's a very personal issue for me. I mean, either exercise a lot more or hope for electric bikes, because I don't know that we can solve that. I mean, it's a real issue. And even for something like bike share in Syracuse, what they've seen in Montreal is that all the bikes start up at the top of the plateau, and they spend all day moving them back by truck. So it's true. It's a real issue. So I think it's something we would have to face here, too.
Well, I would just suggest that one option is, again, as you say, ride down the hill and then take the connective corridor bus and put your bike, because I believe all of the buses now do have bike racks on the front. So actually, that's a pretty easy fix that's already there, but that's a very good point. Thank you, Mitch. Yeah. Thank you, Mark Norman.
Thanks.
And thank you all.